This is an ABC podcast.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi, happy Friday. It's time to settle in for the South Australian and Broken Hill Country Hour. You're with me, Cassie Huff. Now, overseas crop yields in some parts of New Zealand and the UK are the stuff of dreams for many South Aussie farmers. But in high rainfall areas like Millicent, a new project is trying to push the envelope a bit to see just how high yields can get in this country. And it's not just rainfall that's making a difference.
So in the high rainfall zones, we're not typically always limited by water, but I think one thing we're now recognising is that we actually might be sometimes also limited by light.
Some interesting work there. Stick around. I'll have more information on that. Also, some stormy weather in the north of the state this morning and overnight. I'll get into that when we get to the weather. But yesterday I was telling you how you may have to keep paying more for shearers for the next few months. The Shearing Contractors Association of Australia is continuing its recommendation to its members to temporarily pay shearers 15% above the award rate due to the lack of workers. Now, Lucas Forbes spoke to some of those in the livestock industry to see what producers think of paying those wages. And not everyone's happy about it, as you can imagine.
Yeah, we just finished shearing in the first week of March.
Jeez, that doesn't look good.
No, it's pretty rough, that's for sure.
That's Neville Hunt, a farmer from Wandera near Port Pirie in the mid-north. He says he's been paying well above award rate to get shearers for the past few years, but that he's been disappointed with their conduct and skill, including one which injured several of his sheep.
Well, I think it's time the award's sorted out. It probably needs a bit of a review with the Livestock Producers SA and the shearers. They're quite happy to pay a bit extra for a good job and no whinging.
Have you had a lot of problems with shearers and, I suppose, their conduct on your place before?
Yeah, mostly in recent times. It's always been there, but yeah, just the last several years, it's getting worse and it needs addressing. I want to stress it's not all shearers. I used to be a shearer myself and am a wool classer. Any other industry, it wouldn't be tolerated in.
So what sort of behaviour are we talking about?
Oh, just their manners, the job they're doing, complaining all the time about anything and everything.
Wandera farmer Neville Hunt speaking. Corn farmer Ben Kahn Sr. will have 7,000 sheep to shear in August and says he's worried that once the price for shears has gone up, it won't come back down again.
I don't really know whether it's going to do much good anyway. The more you give them, the more they really want. But, you got to find a reason of why they want more money.
Well, in this case, it's to, I suppose, put an end to the bidding war. I suppose the competition for shearers due to the lack of shearers with the COVID-19 closing the border to New Zealand. I suppose, what do you make of that?
Oh, well, no doubt there's a shortage of shearers at the moment. But like I said, we've seen it all before in the 70s. And when you get a demand, eventually you'll get supply. So eventually more people will take it up if there's more demand for it. But it's just hard to find people now that want to do the work.
Do you think that if even once this recommendation ceases, I suppose, how do you think that might impact what shearers expect to be paid afterwards?
Oh, I can't see the price of shearing going down. Once it's gone up, it'll stay up. I can't see any reason.
What are you thinking about how much you might have to pay in wages in August?
Oh, well, I wouldn't like to think, but yeah, I'd probably over $7, I'd say we'll have to pay something over $7 a head, so you work it out for yourself, $7 for 7,000, so $49,000, I presume, something you're up around there. Well, that, you know, it'll probably be more than $7, could be up towards $8 now.
Corn farmer Ben Kahn Sr. speaking. Livestock SA President Joe Keynes says he's worried the recommendation could create a new higher shearing award rate for all intents and purposes.
It does send a bit of a message that, you know, producers are beholden to pay what, you know, and to some degree are going to be held to ransom to say, well, this is the shearing award rate and we'll bump it up to wherever we like if you want to get shearers. And I think it's better if we actually negotiate with our shearing staff. We understand it's hard work, and if the job is done really well, I think producers would like to pay the award rate and above if they do the job well.
Livestock SA President Joe Keynes speaking. Wandeera farmer Neville Hunt says he feels at the moment farmers are spending a lot of energy just trying to keep shearers happy.
Well, firstly, I hear a lot about the shearers are on the radio about pay rates and one thing or another. I just thought it's about time that some of the wool growers spoke up and said what's really happening out there.
And I suppose to sum it up for people who are not familiar with this industry, what is really happening as you see it?
Well, the shearers are doing what they like, charging what they want. Most growers are just tiptoeing around the shed, trying not to upset the shearers, not going to pull them into gear. Yeah, just things like that.
Wandeera farmer Neville Hunt ending that story from Lucas Forbes, following on from the story that we had yesterday from the Shearing Contractors Association of Australia that recommended shearers be paid 15% above the award rate due to the lack of workers that's being seen in that industry at the moment. And it seems like there's still quite a lot of pinch points going on, even with a bit more relaxation of borders in Australia at the moment, thanks to less COVID around. But moving from sheep to wheat now. Now, they might not have broken the world record of 17.3 tonnes a hectare for a wheat crop, but researchers are still pleased with the results from the first hyper-yielding crop trials in the lower southeast last year. The work's part of a larger yield potential project that the organisation is doing across the high rainfall zones of Australia. Research director Dr. Kenton Porker says they're chasing both sustainability and grain yield with this project.
They're really aiming for how can we consistently achieve above 10-tonne yields in both barley and wheat? And we almost got there in barley this year, so we got to 9.83 tonne, but we got there in wheat, so we're in around 10.5 tonne in wheat. So it was an exciting year, and for the first time as well, we now had canola in South Australia, so a hyper-yielding canola trial as well. So we had all three crops, barley, wheat and canola.
What do you think caused those yields to nearly or reach the 10-tonne a hectare point?
I don't think we quite got the yields we were expecting due to a number of things. So in the high rainfall zones, we're not typically always limited by water, but I think one thing we're now recognising is that we actually might be sometimes also limited by light. So plant needs solar radiation to actually grow and accumulate biomass. If you actually have a look at what happened in 2020, is that during October, it was actually quite cloudy and the light conditions were, I guess it was quite dreary. And whilst we had the rainfall, crops simply didn't have enough light to achieve greater than 10 tonne in that environment. So they're actually light limited and not water limited. That was part of the story. And there was also a relatively warm day during November, which could have caused some heat stress and heat shock and reduce grain weight and reduce a little bit of sterility in some wheat cultivars.
It's getting closer to sowing time for this coming season. Will you be changing anything up for the second year of the trial?
Sure. I think the big change was we've always believed that we needed to be sowing early to achieve the high yields. But I think what the last few years, certainly in the southeast, has demonstrated that the season is actually quite different to some of the other high rainfall zones, and that high yields can also be achieved from delaying planting into May. So typically we have targeted April sowing dates, but we actually achieved higher yields in barley from delaying sowing date into May last year. So we're still keeping the April sowing times this year, but we are also having a much bigger focus on, well, how can we achieve yields now from crops that are emerging slightly later. The other big change will be certainly in canola. We now have the option to have GM crops in South Australia. So a big focus on what germplasm or what new genetics can actually drive yield and productivity in that environment now that we have access to a whole heap of new genetics.
And have you found that pushing for those higher yields in these crops comes at the expense of quality or pest resistance or anything?
Certainly disease is the big pressure. So if you don't control disease, it's really difficult to achieve the 10-tonne crops. So it is a higher input system. But I think what we're really trying to find is even improved genetic resistance to disease, where we don't have to have as many fungicide applications, where we don't have to have the higher inputs. And certainly there is the germplasm coming out of Europe that's enabling us to do that. So that part is really exciting. And I think once you get all the management right, quality is not so much a big factor in this environment. So we're now achieving, in barley, we're achieving malting specifications. In wheat, we're still getting the high yields out of what we call the red feed wheat. So the milling wheat aren't getting as high a yield. So there is a compromise there, certainly, but that's more of a background genetic compromise, and the focus on breeding for milling wheat has typically been in the low to medium rainfall environments of Australia, and a lot of what we're playing with is coming straight out of Europe. So I think we're just a little bit behind in their development.
You mentioned that the high rainfall zone here in the southeast of South Australia is a little different to other high rainfall zones. What do you mean by that, and how do you change planting to accommodate for that?
I think it is just a very kind and favourable environment, and I would say that the flowering dates for the lower southeast compared to some of the other environments, so I'm talking about Victoria and certainly Western Australia, they typically require their crops to be flowering a little bit earlier and are more drought stressed, or even have more likelihood of getting some heat stress during grain fill. So I think what's certainly about Millicent and also in Tasmania is that it could actually be flowering a little bit later, and the stress of heat and drought is less likely to occur during grain fill in those environments. And I think that's what gives you the flexibility in sowing date. So sowing date's really important, but I think in that part of the high rainfall zone, there is actually quite a lot of flexibility in that sowing date to achieve the high yields.
FAR Australia Research Director Dr. Kenton Porker speaking to Bridget Herman about the hyper-yielding crop trials at Millicent. And with the way prices held up this year, a 10-ton crop wouldn't have gone astray, I can't imagine. It would have been quite a handy little pay packet if you could pull that off year in, year out. So we'll see, keep across that hyper-yielding crop trial. We're still a long way behind some of the crops they can get in New Zealand and the UK, Europe, but it's good to know what you can achieve with some tightened conditions and a bit of research. We'll keep following that. It is 17 minutes past 12.
Afternoons with Sonia Feldhoff.
Rose Hepps, co-writer and director of Australia in Colour, things that we've only ever seen in black and white.
When we see black and white footage, it's code for the past, and we immediately look at it. Oh, well, that's something that happened in the past.
With distance.
Black and white. When you colourise the footage, this magical thing happens where it comes to life, and you think, that person is just like you or me.
Sonia Feldhoff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
The Department of Environment and Water is developing a new forecasting tool to work out just how much water should be released through the Lower Lakes barrages. Analysts are creating a new online portal which will be released for community consultation later this year. Healthy Coorong Healthy Basin manager Angus McGregor says it's about using existing water quality data to provide better transparency.
Our broader Project Coorong initiative includes a water resource optimisation project. Now, that project is about expanding the existing water quality monitoring network in the Coorong and developing new water quality monitoring programs. But more importantly, it includes a component that's going to be the development of this, as you say, a Coorong automated forecasting system. Now, what that does is it captures weather conditions, water quality monitoring data, and ecological modelling to forecast when and how much water should be released through the barrages for the best environmental benefit for the Coorong region.
And how does it bring all these different facets together?
So it's essentially an IT or computer software system. So it's something that we're developing now with business and IT analysts. And then later this year, we're going to be embarking on a community consultation process and having that conversation with community around, well, look, if we're trying to increase the transparency and community access to data and information behind decision making, what does a community want to be able to access, and how does it want that public or community interface online to look like?
So I guess there is the idea that once it is all up and running and live, it would be like an online portal or something that people would click on and get this information?
Yeah, absolutely. So this year we're very much focusing on the back-end system development and trying to understand from an IT perspective how we integrate existing water quality data that's real, live and telemetered at the moment, and you can go onto Water Connect, our website, and see some of that data. But how do we bring that together with the Bureau of Meteorology forecast, some of our Coorong ecological modelling and other database information to have that, you know, publicly accessible in an online portal in real time?
Why was there a need from Healthy Basin, Healthy Coorong and the department to make this online and accessible to the public?
Well, we know that monitoring data is critical for maintaining the ecological character of the Coorong, and the majority of the ecological character is driven directly by the volume, timing and quality of water that passes down the river and through the lower lakes and Coorong. Data collection needs to reflect these parameters and be spatially representative and to enable decision makers basically to understand change, to provide timely responses to ecological risks and make evidence-based decisions. And what this is all about is making sure that as much as anything, there's rigour and transparency around that decision making. So, you know, everyone would appreciate that the management of the river, the lower lakes and the Coorong is a highly contested space. And one of the things we're trying to do here is, I guess, improve the robustness and transparency around that decision making. So how do we want to make sure that we're capturing management decisions and the basis of those decisions is communicated and understood by the community, and the community has an ability to access the information that we use to inform that decision making. So it's about improved transparency, but also improving communication and general community awareness and understanding of the site and the system.
Yes, I guess education is at the heart of it as well.
Absolutely. And so we're really looking forward to, again, once we build the back end of these new IT systems, starting that conversation with the community later this year around what they would want out of these online portals going forward.
And Angus, for people who don't, you know, fully understand what happens down in that part of the river system at the moment, how much water is currently being released through the barrages and, you know, would this modelling forecasting kind of change that amount?
So I don't have those figures to hand because I'm not in a direct river operations role, but that information is provided through weekly flow reports and so it is publicly accessible. But these new systems aren't likely to necessarily change or increase those bulk volumes, but they will enable us to make, I guess, more nuanced operational decisions so that the release of water can be more targeted, strategic, and therefore give better environmental outcomes. So it's not about getting more water, it's about making better use of the water we have.
Healthy Coorong, Healthy Basin Manager Angus McGregor speaking to Anita Ward. And speaking about rigour and transparency in the basin, the government, the federal government, has released the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission's long-anticipated review of water trading. It found that market manipulation is not prohibited and says that insider trading obligations need to be tightened. The report makes 29 recommendations to government, including to establish a new independent water market agency to oversee the trading that takes place in the basin. Releasing the report, Water Minister Keith Pitt says that it will take the cooperation of the basin states to implement the majority of the recommendations, but he has given no commitment as to when the government will respond to that report. Now, that report has just been released. For more information, we'll have some more information up online at abc.net.au/rural very soon. Also have some reactions and more information on the Country Hour on Monday morning, Monday afternoon during the Country Hour. There'll be a bit of fallout from that. But we'll stay somewhat with weather. We'll find out what's happening more with what's falling from the sky than coming down the river. I'm joined by Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology, Simon Timke. Good afternoon.
Hi there, Cassie.
So a bit of a storm and some activity in the pastoral region again overnight. What happened?
Yeah, it's mostly in the west. We've had an upper trough move across the west of the state, and there's been quite a big band of middle-level cloud ahead of that. And it was quite active over sort of the inland parts of the West Coast District and the southern half or so of the Northwest Pastoral District. And we did get a little bit reaching the ground out of it too. The rainfall totals up to 9 a.m. this morning. Commonwealth Hill Station sort of out in the middle of the south of the Northwest Pastoral District 25 millimetres, Nundroo 24, Maralinga 15 millimetres, Tarcoola 14 millimetres. Roxby Downs 11 millimetres. And as that band's moved eastwards, we've seen a few places around the Flinders Ranges sort of pick up 7 or 8 millimetres. Lee Creek's had 6 millimetres. Cooper Petey's had a few. Marie's had a few. So, and the lightning has sort of eased back a little bit, but I think there's still a possibility sort of through that area that we'll see some storms redevelop again this afternoon as a surface trough moves across. So has been a little bit of rainfall out west overnight and this morning, Cassie.
So do you think that's going to continue across South Australia for the next few days?
Yeah, I think today's probably the most interesting day and the most likely day to see much around. So as that band of middle-level cloud moves across, I think showers are possible over most parts, apart from the far northeast, and then isolated thunderstorms possible over the northwest pasture or the west coast district, still maybe very far northern Eyre Peninsula, and the Flinders and the mid-north districts are a chance as well this afternoon, and the western part of the northeast pastoral, all those places, chance of seeing a thunderstorm today. And I think the sort of the southeastern part of the northwest pastoral district is an area where there's a chance there could be some severe thunderstorms. It's quite a moist atmosphere, and as the surface trough moves across, we'd be a chance of seeing a bit of gusty wind, maybe possibly some brief local heavy falls, and even a little bit of hail possible over that part. So, an interesting day today, but overnight we'll see that middle level cloud band contract to the east, and the showers will be a little bit more restricted tomorrow. A little bit of fog possible in the west and north to start off with, and then just a slight to medium chance of showers about the southern agricultural area and near the west coast, and those showers gradually contracting southwards during the afternoon to be near southern coasts by evening. And in the far north, a chance of a possible shower or thunderstorm. A little bit left over. You know, if it does get a bit active this afternoon and evening, then we could get some early morning stuff. But I think by afternoon, those showers and thunderstorms will be restricted to sort of the far northwest. And then continued easing on Sunday, where the showers will be restricted really just to sort of near central and southern coasts, and the very far northwest of the state, possible rumble of thunder up there, maybe a little bit of fog around too, about the south. And then Monday, sort of ridge, the high pressure system itself sort of moves across the south. We fall into a more of a stable weather pattern, and then that high pressure system moves out to over the Tasman Sea, but it continues to extend a ridge back over South Australia. So right through Monday through to Friday, we stay under the influence of that ridge. So very stable weather and dry conditions pretty much right through Monday to Friday next week. Chance of seeing a little bit of fog around Monday morning and again Tuesday morning about the southeast Murraylands and Kangaroo Island districts, and maybe a slight chance of a shower in the very far south of the lower southeast district on Monday. But then Tuesday through Friday, dry with temperatures slowly climbing too, with that high out to the east over the Tasman. We'll get more northeast to northwesterly winds over SA, and we'll see those temperatures slowly rise during the week, so that by Friday we'll be hot through most of the state, or at least warm to hot. So yeah, certainly getting gradually hotter through the week. As far as the rainfall totals go for that 4-day period out till midnight Tuesday, most of the rainfall will be today and Saturday, I think. Generally less than 5 millimetres, but we'll see some slightly higher falls with thunderstorms. I think it'll stay dry in the far northeast. And today, a chance of seeing rainfall totals, like I read out earlier, falls of sort of 10 to 30 millimetres over the south of the northwest pastoral, western parts of the northeast pastoral, and local falls of 30 to 50 millimetres are possible in that southeastern part of the northwest pastoral district, where those thunderstorms are a little bit more likely this afternoon. So a little bit wet for the next couple of days, but pretty much dry after Monday, Cassie.
And warming up. We'll keep across that as we head into the Easter long weekend. Thanks for that, Simon.
Thanks, Cassie.
Simon Timke speaking there about some of the interesting weather that was seen across the west of the state overnight and this morning. In the upper western region of the far west of New South Wales, it's going to be mostly sunny tomorrow. Overnight temperatures will get down to about 15 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high 20s. The lower western will be mostly sunny. Overnight temperatures there will fall to about 13 degrees, but the daytime temperatures will reach the mid to high high 20s. Text has come in on that Coorong story. It says, is it Coorong at all costs or are other water needs considered southeast drainage at some stage needs a full review? Thanks for your text. It's coming up to 12:30.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Cassie Huff. Cassie Huff.
Hi, so glad you could join me this afternoon. Tell me, are you a fan of the mandarin? They're a handy fruit, I find. A bit easier to eat than oranges if you're feeling like a citrus fruit. But Australia's largest mandarin growing region is feeling the pinch workers-wise.
You spend a year trying to grow the fruit. It's just very disappointing when it can't be harvested.
I'll have more on how the Queensland citrus harvest is going. They're a little ahead of the South Australian season, but South Australia is not far away as well. So that'll be all coming up in the next 15 minutes or so. And a historic agreement on the Eyre Peninsula. I'll take you over there in the next 10 minutes or so to find out what's been decided there between Teaports and the local Indigenous group. But first, we have to find out what's making news with Wendy Klamajak. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Australia's wine industry is bracing for China to extend large tariffs for the next 5 years. Beijing imposed interim tariffs of up to 200% last year, claiming that Australia has subsidised its industry and sold wine below the cost of production. Australia denies any anti-competitive behaviour. A new report is warning that the gender pay gap in Australia will probably continue for more than 25 years because of views that devalue women. The study found that workplaces, homes and institutions continue to hold attitudes towards women that discriminate against them. People travelling into South Australia are being advised to download the MySA Gov app prior to entering the state. From tomorrow, travellers will now be required to scan a QR code specific to Adelaide Airport straight after their arrival. Those without a smartphone must provide their contact details to an authorised person. And a rarely seen artwork by the Dutch painter Vincent van Gogh has sold at auction for nearly $22 million. The painting, hidden away in a private collection for more than a century, shows a couple walking along a rural lane in front of a windmill. More ABC News at 1 o'clock.
Thanks for that, Wendy. Now, as Wendy Klamajak mentioned, winemakers and grape growers expect China will lock in and possibly increase hefty tariffs applied to Aussie wine in coming days. It could even happen as early as today. This has been an ongoing issue, and Australian Grape and Wine Chief Executive Tony Badalene says that the tariff will likely apply for the next 5 years, and that could possibly prompt a complaint to the World Trade Organization.
The way the timeline goes is you're issued with an investigation, then you are issued with interim tariffs, and of course there's two investigations, one into dumping and one into subsidies. So we're issued with these interim tariffs in October, November. And then following that, there's a certain amount of time goes through while they consider the applications, and we of course put in oppositions and provided information as to all the companies who were mentioned. We all cooperated fully. What happens then is there's a statement of essential facts released, and that was released about 2 weeks ago. And that basically comes through and says, these are our responses to your submissions, and this is what the final tariff will look like. You have 10 days to respond. We've just gone through that 10-day period now, and the permanent tariffs that they're recommending or suggesting are a little bit higher than the interim tariffs.
So we were talking of tariffs up to 200%. How much is a little bit higher than that?
Oh, we're probably up in the 215 to 218% mark. So it doesn't matter at the margin. So when you're at 200%, you're not viable. When you're at 215%, you're even less viable. So the market remains closed to Australian wine.
And you're expecting that will now be in place for 5 years, similar to what we saw with the barley trade?
That's right. The normal time period for these duties is 5 years, and then it can be reviewed during that time. But certainly in the immediate term, it will put on for 5 years.
And I mentioned there parallels with the Bali case. We've seen the Australian government kickstart WTO, World Trade Organization, action against China because of those Bali tariffs. Could we assume that the Australian wine industry would want the Australian government to do the same in this instance?
I think so. So it's been very disappointing about the outcome, or what we presume will be the outcome about this, but we're not surprised, and we continue to reject the allegations. So for us, China is someone who continually promotes the importance of the World Trade Organization, so we'll certainly evaluate very carefully the possibility of a challenge within that. We are meeting as a board, as an industry, on the 7th of April. That's one of the items on the agenda. But my view is that we will probably go through the proper channels because we reject the allegations.
You're expecting China to confirm these tariffs or lock them in for the next 5 years as soon as possibly this weekend?
Yeah, I think it's imminent. What happens with the interim tariffs on dumping, the timeframe before they need to either review or extend was up to the 26th of March. That day, we're just about the 26th, so we're expecting that to be the trigger for the final announcement of both the subsidies and the dumping tariffs.
Meanwhile, what are Australian winemakers and grape growers doing?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, we're immediately seeing some impacts on price for grapes. We're in the middle of vintage, as you know. So we're seeing a 10 to 15% reduction on red wine prices across the board. In some cases, a little bit more. What we're also probably going to see is some impact on the spot market at the end of the vintage. What we are doing, though, to get through this is we've been working very closely with the Australian government. They announced around $72.7 million in December to help agribusiness expand export markets. So we're working up some proposals to look at both market diversification, but also market access issues in the short, medium and long term. So we've got a long term issue here. So we need to look at the structure of the industry. We need to look at those markets. We need to look at market access, and we need to work very hard to try and grow those markets.
Tony Badaline from Australian Grape and Wine speaking to Kath Sullivan about the latest development in the trade tensions between Australia and China when it comes to wine. We'll keep following that developing story. But yesterday I told you about the news that Teaports, which is a grain exporter at Lucky Bay on the Eyre Peninsula, that they've signed an agreement with the Bungala people to give them a shareholding in the port. The Bungala Determination Aboriginal Corporation, or DMAC, will be partners in Teaports' shareholder structure, and it will recognise the rights of the First Nation peoples as the custodians of the land. So today they're holding a special event to recognise this agreement, and Brooke Nindorf is there. Good afternoon, Brooke.
Hi, Cathy.
So what's happening at Lucky Bay today?
Yeah, we are at Lucky Bay today. It's a beautiful, beautiful day today, nice and overcast. So hopefully that means a bit of rain on the horizon for those over here on the Eastern Eyre Peninsula. But we've seen the ferry arrive and leave again with people. We've got the Lucky Eyre, which is the grain transshipment vessel. It's parked up right here at the port as well. And a great crowd has turned up for the recognition of this agreement. It's a pretty special day for the community. And our Teaports and the Bungala Determination Aboriginal Corporation and Bungala people. So it's a pretty special day for those communities.
So what does this agreement mean?
So the Lucky Bay Port Indigenous Land Use Agreement essentially means that it provides partnership in the project as a shareholder agreement with the Bungala people. They're partners in the Teaports shareholder structure. So it's been several years in the making, and Teaports has said that they're very happy to finally have it come to fruition. So as part of this agreement, this corporation between Teaports and BDAC, they'll look to develop a Bungala Ranger program, have support scholarships for the Bungala students, and also provide job opportunities as well.
So what, Brooke, does that mean for the Bungala community as well?
Yeah, they're pretty proud to be a part of this. Now, there's a lot of representatives here from the Bungala community today, and it's great to speak to many of them about the importance of this recognition. A special sign has been unveiled that'll be here at the port to acknowledge this as well. And I caught up with Jason Bilney. He's the chair of the Bungala Determination Aboriginal Corporation, and I asked him what this agreement means to the Bungala community.
It means a lot to us as Bungala, but all Indigenous people around Australia, setting a precedent and having, being a part of the deal and renegotiating Indigenous land use agreements, but also pushing for share ownership. So it's an historic deal for Bungala, one of the first ones to be renegotiated for Bungala, and becoming share ownership. And taking share ownership is a big thing. It's not about money or income. It's about being there and taking the next step and being a part of the project and actually taking share ownership.
How long has this process taken?
This process has been a sort of very hard and long process. It's probably been about 5 years. Bear in mind, going from renegotiating it from a ferry terminal to a commodities port. So no, it's been a very long one, but it's just been very good along the way as well doing it.
How would the agreement work for the Bungala community?
The agreement works with the Bungala community. Well, it's just Teaport's actually run it all. We just take share ownership. It creates a ranger program, creates employment and opportunities for Bungala people as well.
You spoke about the ranger program and your employment opportunities there for particularly young people in the Bungala community. Are there kids that are keen to come on board, and what have you found out so far with how this will work?
There's always the next generation coming out of school, so doing school-based stuff and coming out. Also people that's left school and, you know, getting into those programs, and also retraining a lot of the older generation as well, and being a part of it as well.
Jason Bilney, also you touched on in the release for today about the respect involved with this agreement. Tell us about that.
It's the respect. It's a two-way street. So, you know, it's a respecting the company with doing the deal that they're doing, but it's also having the respect for us as Bungala traditional owners, and we're here not to stop progress of our area being Eyre Peninsula, let alone development. It's about being at the table, and, you know, so, and respect, and for the companies respecting us as Indigenous people of the area, and respecting our significance, culture, you know, being on country.
Jason Bilney, thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
That was Jason Bilney. He's the chair of the Bungala Determination Aboriginal Corporation, one of the members of the Bungala community here today at Lucky Bay. And Cathy, on Monday we'll hear more from Teaports and Kieran Carville about this agreement today.
Well, it does sound like a great day. Look forward to hearing more on how this agreement pans out. Thanks for your time today, Brooke.
Thanks, Cathy.
Brooke Nindorf there at Lucky Bay. Sounds like a lovely day to be there, and what a great initiative. It is 19 minutes to 1.
What a glorious time to garden. The April issue of ABC Gardening Australia magazine brings you great solutions for shady spots and ways to blitz those autumn weeds. Learn about habitat trees, plant stocks for spring colour, and weave an Easter basket. And down in the patch, get heaps of practical advice with the new expanded section on growing edibles. Gardening Australia magazine, available from newsagents and abcmagazines.com.au.
You're listening to Cassie Huff on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
A fan of mandarins. Someone once told me that the segment of a mandarin is called a piglet, and I believed them, and I have called mandarin segments piglets my whole life, but I was recently informed that that is not the case, and they were pulling my leg. But I do enjoy a mandarin, but if you, like me, do, you can probably expect to pay higher prices for the fruit this winter, because the major citrus-growing region in Queensland, the North Burnett, is struggling to find workers, as Joanna Marie reports.
Well, we cater just for backpackers, and they are very, very thin on the ground at the moment. This time last year we would have had a couple hundred people on Facebook wanting to come for the citrus season. This year we haven't got any.
Mark Possel owns a backpackers hostel in Mundubbera in Queensland's North Burnett. Walking the hallways, you can see room after room of empty bunk beds, and the lights are out in communal areas normally packed with travellers.
We're always full, chock-a-block full through the citrus season. This year we'll be lucky to be half full. And how that's going to play out for the orchardists and farmers, we're not sure, but it doesn't look positive to me.
The North Burnett is Australia's largest growing region for mandarins. 2,000 people are needed during the peak of the harvest, which is just about to start. And there's not enough locals in the region to fill the positions.
So these are imperial mandarins. The country that they're on, it's a bit of a... the crop here usually comes in a little bit earlier. So we will be chasing people probably in 2 to 3 weeks' time. And we're going to struggle to fill all the positions.
What does that mean if you can't find the workers?
The fruit doesn't get harvested. You spend a year trying to grow the fruit, it's just very disappointing when it can't be harvested.
Anne Baton from Blue Cow Citrus says some growers with the capability of on-farm quarantine are organising seasonal workers from the Pacific Islands. But that seems highly unlikely for her family's farm and many other smaller growers.
We have applied to get seasonal workers on the seasonal worker program, but I can't see us getting any this year. We don't have the accommodation on farm to be able to support that. Maybe the following year, we'll just have to wait and see.
Federal member for Flynn, Ken O'Dowd, agrees the seasonal worker program needs to be improved.
When you're working with other countries and also other state government, it's everyone's got to fall in the line as quickly as possible. There is a backpacker establishment in Mundubbera. I'd like to see that establishment approved as soon as possible to quarantine.
Do you fear that it is too late now for the citrus season, or at least the start of the citrus season, just a couple of weeks away?
Yeah, well, as you said, 2 weeks away, doesn't take long to go. And when the fruit's ready, it's got to come off. If it doesn't come off, well, we've got big troubles there.
If less fruit is picked this year, supply to supermarkets will be reduced. That will likely mean higher prices on the shelves.
It is correct. The prices will rise accordingly to what they can pick and what seasonal fruits are out at that time. We have seen a little bit of a price rise in the last couple of weeks, not a huge amount yet, but it is on the cards, it might happen.
Bundaberg produce shop owner April Elazzi says it could also mean more imported fruit and vegetables making an appearance.
Imported fruit will always cost more money. It could be anywhere from double the price what you're going to pay here. I think that people would rather see it grown here in our country. If that does happen, if we do have a shortage in fruit and veggies, our only option is to buy from overseas. Hopefully we don't get to that stage, and hopefully we can keep the workers on what the pickers and the farmers need to be able to get their jobs done.
Bundaberg produce shop owner April Elazzi ending that report by Joanna Marie. Now in South Australia, 1,200 Pacific Island workers will be quarantined regionally, and they are being brought in to help with the South Australian citrus harvest. So the situation is a little different here in South Australia, but it sounds like the mandarin price will be affected regardless. So hopefully they can get the workers they need there to get that lovely, delicious fruit off. Finally today, drought and destocking have reduced Australia's cattle herd to levels not seen since the 90s. That's pushed up beef prices. You might have already seen that at your butcher shop. And with widespread flooding affecting the amount of cattle going through yards at sale yards, the prices have spiked again. The Ecky, which is the average price for young cattle, and they're the main cattle that butchers buy, the price there closed at $887.50 a kilogram yesterday. That is just a sniff off the record of $888.25 a kilo, which was set in January. So a very high price there. But Jennifer Nichols is taking a look at how the stakeholders right across the industry and the supply chain are affected.
This B-Double's delivering valuable cargo from the drought-stricken South Burnett to Dalby on Queensland's Western Downs. In a climate of high cattle prices and poor rainfall, Leanne and Brendan O'Brien are some of the few graziers in their district in a position to buy in cattle.
Afternoon.
The couple has worked hard to realise their dream of becoming full-time farmers and give their five young girls the chance to grow up on the land. Restocking's expensive, including tick treatment and transport. These cattle cost $65,000.
Right, we'll get these unloaded.
They'll be fattened for up to 70 days before being unsold. Every kilo gained on pasture counts. The O'Briens are banking on the cattle market remaining high.
These 58 Droughtmaster heifers here represent a lot for Brendan and myself and our family, with the passion of livestock and farming.
The O'Briens took the plunge into share farming with a relative when their fencing business stalled during drought. Their strategy includes feeding supplementary grain, installing watering points, and fencing smaller paddocks for cell grazing.
Hey.
Cattle are moved between blocks to let native pastures rest and recover.
A few days ago, they finished off in here, and they come into a paddocks like this one here, and spend the next few days in there, depending on our grazing practices and that, and size of the paddock as well. It's amazing by doing the cell grazing at how you can have fodder in your paddocks at such a dry period.
So how do you make a profit when the prices that you're buying at the moment are so sky high?
It has been difficult to see them go up when you're buying, but it's also very good when you're selling. So, yeah, it's all relative to the market. Yeah, if you buy and sell in the same market.
They rely on their livestock agent.
100 centimetre, 3 bit of it, 300 centimetre, 3 bit of it, 300 centimetre, 100 cent will come in, going at 300 cents. Eldest Toowoomba 1000 takes the buck bull.
Brendan Gilliland searches far and wide to first find them the right cattle for fattening and then secure good prices, selling direct to supermarkets, feedlots and through sale yards.
Gone are the days where you can buy some steers, throw them in the paddock and sell them when the tax man says sell them, or the bank account needs money. You've got to have a plan. When you buy your cattle for our clients, you've got to know exactly where those cattle are going to go at the other end.
After years of extreme drought, Australia's cattle herd fell to 24.6 million head last year, its lowest level since the early 1990s. It's a key factor in the current high prices. In January, the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator, a seven-day rolling average of young cattle from 25 sale yards across Queensland, New South Wales and Victoria, hit a new record of 888 cents per kilogram of dressed carcass. Jason Strong is the Managing Director of Meat and Livestock Australia.
So the extremes from the low in 19 to the high in January this year was 127%.
For even the littlest livestock, there's been a stark turnaround. Agent Peter Bird explains.
You know, $900 for a 100-kilo calf. 2 years ago, you know, not even, 18 months ago, young calves, $10, $15, $20 was common.
Prices are up 60% on the 19-year average.
4.41
More than 4,000 cattle were traded at Queensland's second largest sale yards when Landline visited Dalby. This year, prices have been unprecedented. Ian Henderson manages the sale yards.
They're just climbing, 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 but nobody knows how far it's going to go.
During drought, Australia's 450 accredited feedlots, like this one at Wonga Plains, have helped guarantee consistency of supply for Australia's $28.5 billion red meat and livestock industry.
Some 1.5 million head of cattle capacity to be held in feedlots at any one time, and the production system represents about 40% of the Australian beef production here domestically.
Australian Lot Feeders Association President Bryce Cam says even with grain costs easing, high cattle prices are mauling feedlot margins.
On a typical 100-day grain-fed trade, there could be losses on that trade based on the price of cattle coming in of around $100 per head.
Abattoirs are also making significant losses, forcing cutbacks in shifts. Live export relationships are being tested. Two-thirds of Australia's beef is exported to more than 100 markets. The death of millions of pigs to African swine fever has created opportunities. Jason Strong again.
From a demand and supply point of view, there's a huge, huge hole in the global protein supply.
The Australian Bureau of Agricultural and Resource Economics and Sciences estimates cattle prices will fall 7% this year, driven by greater domestic cattle availability and lower global beef prices.
If you had a few words to describe the current market, what would they be?
You'd have to start with it's exciting. not for everybody, but it's certainly exciting. But I say that from the point of view of what's possible.
Jason Strong from Meat and Livestock Australia. And you can see that full story on Landline at 12:30 p.m. on Sunday on ABC TV to get a better understanding of why your beef costs so much at the butcher shop these days. Finally today, irrigation pumps in the Murray-Darling Basin are responsible for the loss of about 97 million fish each year, according to the Murray-Darling Basin Authority. Fish, fingerlings, eggs, larvae and other water life and debris are being sucked into thousands of irrigation pumps throughout the river system. But a solution could be coming soon with fish screening technology that's been inspired by a US trial in New South Wales and Victoria. Anthea Moody reports.
Millions of native fish are being killed in the Murray-Darling Basin by irrigation pumps each year. According to Craig Copeland, it's all preventable. He's the founder of Ausfish Unlimited, a not-for-profit organisation dedicated to helping recreational fishers. He says the fish screens are a mutual benefit to both fish stocks and irrigators, making pumps more efficient.
Absolutely essential and should have been happening a long time ago. The good modern irrigation screens are just better for farming. You know, we've got farmers who have spent hours cleaning out their sprinkler heads or hours, you know, back flushing their pumps. And with the new modern irrigation screens, they don't have to do that. So there's a big cost incentive and an efficiency incentive for farmers. So everyone wins.
Why do you think it's been so long for Australia to start implementing these things when similar technology has been happening in America for quite some time?
In part, it took the land care movement a long time to really get going. And part of it was farmers sharing stories with other farmers. And that's what we don't have in Australia. So, yes, we've got technology overseas. We've got the designs. We've now proved it up in Australia. What we don't have is enough examples so farmers go and have a look at it and make sure that it's going to fit their situation. As the bloke that's the head of this program says, the best way to sell these screens is another farmer with a screen. So we just need more of them, and I think it'll take off.
What is the environmental importance of keeping a healthy fish population?
It's not just an environmental importance. You know, that speaks for itself. It's actually the economic importance. The recreational fishing in the basin is worth over $1 billion a year. It's one of the biggest industries in the basin. People travel for miles to go fishing for yellow belly and cod. These screens, you know, are going to make a huge difference to that fishery and the economies of towns. People would likely to go out there and catch more fish. They're going to be more likely to travel.
Although in its early stages, the fish screening technology is gaining more awareness in the Northern Basin. Principal Project Officer at Southern Queensland Landscapes, Dr. Paul Webb, spoke with a range of groups on the border rivers to introduce the idea. He says he received mixed responses.
The recreational fishers and Aboriginal people and some of the irrigators were really favourable in terms of the awareness of just how many native fish are removed from the system with evolving science around this. The irrigators themselves, and particularly the larger irrigators, were just, I guess, a little bit guarded in their response, and their reservations were partly about, you know, the effectiveness of the screening and whether it would impact on the reliability of pumping infrastructure and whether it would just end up being damaged or washed down the river by floods and debris. The irrigators were also a little bit worried about what ongoing costs were, you know, for maintaining and operating and maintaining the works and, if need be, repairing them.
If all things go to plan, when do you think that these fish-friendly water infrastructure will be implemented in Queensland?
The dream would be that we get, in the next 12 months, we get a few people to have a go at it. And once a few people have had a go at it, we start getting some momentum, and in two ways. One, in terms of funding streams for state and Commonwealth investment in incentives, but also in removal of some of those reservations from irrigators and local governments to having a go at installing this, and so we get some momentum behind it. In the long run, it's going to be, you know, years, if not decades, before we actually get a lot of or universal uptake, but we've got to start somewhere. And I guess for every megalitre that we screen coming out of the river, there's a few fish less getting removed from the what's already arguably a depleted system.
Southern Queensland Landscapes Principal Project Officer, Dr. Paul Webb. While the discussions take time, Craig Copeland says the sooner the screens are implemented, the better.
risk is that we're going to stay the same. We're going to have a poor fish population. It's not going to improve. And that's from a fish point of view. But the worst thing is it's going to affect farmers. A lot of them have tried to be screened anyway, but the screens are wrong. They don't actually keep debris out, and they don't keep fish eggs and larvae out. So they're a bit of a waste of time. What they also do is they start blocking the pump and reducing its velocity. So it might seem a little bit of a capital cost up front, but it makes a hell of a difference over time. And the farmers that are using them are saying exactly that.
Greg Copeland from AusFish Unlimited, finishing that report by Anthea Moody. That's what we have time for in the program today. I do hope you have a great weekend planned. It's coming up to news time as it's almost 1 o'clock.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.